This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live. HRRN
Live. But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Top Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna and Jude Feld.
Good afternoon once again, everyone, and welcome to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, Jude Feld, the Pontiff of the Pick Four, getting ready to talk with a couple of individuals tonight and hear their stories as we do each and every week here on Trainer Talk. And JT, we have the privilege of talking to so many great people, hearing so many great stories. Some stories parallel each other, some are completely opposite, but that's what makes this game great.
A fantastic experience to listen to these stories, find out how trainers fell in love with the game and how they view our sport and what we can look forward to them with them in the future.
And do want to extend a special welcome to everybody just joining us across the country on Sirius 93. For everybody listening online at horseracingradio.net, welcome to the program here this evening. And our two guests here tonight, Kellen Gorder, going to be with us in the first half of the show, and then we'll be joined by Richard Schatzberg in the second half. So let's get right to it. Kellen Gorder with us now, a native of Worthington, Minnesota, and just really getting started with his career. He's trained about 250 winners and many more to come. Kellen, thanks for being with us here on Trainer Talk tonight.
Yeah, thank you. Good morning.
Yeah, happy to have you on board here with us, and looking forward to hearing your story. How on earth does a guy growing up in Worthington, Minnesota, get involved with horse racing?
Yeah, well, Worthington is kind of a farming community down in the southwestern corner of the state of Minnesota. And, you know, I didn't come from a horse background at all. My dad was a teacher and my mom was a secretary, and but I was horse crazy from the time I was 2-3 years old. All I wanted to be was a cowboy. And luckily my neighbor, who lived about a quarter of a mile down the road, had a string of racehorses, and I went to work for him when I was, I guess, old enough to push a wheelbarrow. So I was probably 11 or 12 years old. And, you know, then I started galloping when I was 13. So, and he was the sheriff of my county. And we didn't have, you know, that was before Canterbury Downs was around. So we did all our racing in Sioux City, Nebraska, which was about a 2-hour drive, about 90 miles down the road. So we raced at Park Jefferson, South Dakota, and then we also raced over at Attica Park, which was in Sioux City, Nebraska also. And then some of the littler little tracks like Columbus and Grand Island and some of the Bullring, Nebraska tracks.
If memory serves me correct, that's kind of the same circuit that Wayne Lucas started on back in the day.
Kellen, can you hear us?
Yeah, you're really kind of breaking up.
All right, we'll try and get you here right now. Can you hear? Is that a little bit better?
That's a little bit better, yeah.
Yeah, so as Jude had mentioned, that seems to be the same circuit that D-Wayne Lucas started on when he got rolling with his career.
Yeah. I mean, I think he was just leaving Park Jefferson and those kind of places right when I was first coming around. My boss knew Wayne, and I think Billy Mott's parents live right down the road too. They live in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, which is probably, you know, probably about an hour from where I grew up.
Now, with your parents not being involved in racing at all or involved in horses in any way, what was their reaction when you said, hey, I want to go work around the racetrack?
They were not big fans of it, but once I think they could see how, you know, content I was once I got around horses, that then they kind of started to follow me a little bit. And it's funny now, my dad, he knows my stats better than I do, so he keeps a pretty close eye on what my horses are doing on the racetrack.
Does he ever ask you if your horses are live?
Yeah. He'll call me up and.
It's nice to have your dad be your biggest fan. My dad was my biggest fan when I was training, and he really enjoyed it. But he was a little too polite. He wouldn't go to the winner's circle unless I personally invited him.
Yeah.
So, Kellen, you didn't necessarily start out wanting to be a trainer. If my memory serves me correct, it was more of you wanting to be a jockey in the early stages, right?
Yeah. I was, Steve Coffin was, you know, still riding at that time in the early, you know, in the 70s and 80s. And, he was kind of my hero. So I got my jock's license when I was 16. And, you know, I rode a couple summers for that guy that was my neighbor. His name was Dale Peters. I rode a couple summers, you know, rode mainly his horses for him. So I did actually get to ride a few winners. But by the time I wrestled 98 pounds when I was a junior in high school. By the time I was a senior, I'd jumped up to 112. So shortly after I was graduated from high school, I knew I wasn't going to have a very long-term career as a jockey. So I went on to college at the University of Wisconsin, got an animal science degree. You know, I thought about being a veterinarian, but ultimately decided I wanted to train racehorses.
How much does that animal science degree help you in what you're doing now with training?
I think it is beneficial. Like when we start talking about nutrition and those kind of things, my advisor was a reining horse trainer, and he introduced me to a guy named Ray Hunt, who was kind of he's kind of considered maybe the father of natural horsemanship movement that's kind of taken over the country. And pretty influential in getting me turned on to that kind of style of horsemanship.
I've known you for about 12 years, and I think you're one of the most natural horsemen I've ever met. I mean, you just seem to have a way with the horses. Were you always like that from the very start?
I never have had any fear, and I think, you know, that's always been part of it. I've always tried to learn more and learn from people that are better than me. And, you know, I've always tried to keep a really open mind. And I've just always had great love for the horse.
Talking with trainer Kellen Gorder here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Kellen, a few years back, our good friend Claire Novak with the Blood Horse wrote a piece about you. And one of the things that was in that article was that many of your clients said that you understand and bond with the horses in your care. Is that an accurate assessment?
Yeah, I think it is. It's it's gotten a little more difficult to do as my numbers have grown. I don't ride as much as I used to. When I first started out, I was, you know, I was on horseback every set, and that's kind of dwindled a little bit. But you know, we try to bond. I mean, you do try to form some kind of a relationship with your horses in your barn, and so.
How do you do that? How do you do that? How do you form that bond?
Well, just I think it's trying to recognize what each horse's personality is, what are his strong points or his weaknesses, and you know, if he's got some issues that need to be addressed. You know, trying to figure out how can I get this horse to go better. You know, does he need blinkers, or does he, you know, does he really, you know, or are you just masking the problem and maybe you should take the blinkers off? Does he need a different rider that's got a little quieter hands, or does he need, you know, a stronger guy that can crank him down? Just, you know, always kind of thinking what can you do to make it better.
Well, those special cases, horses that do have some issues, you've always been very good with those and seem to be able to find the key. And even horses that some relatively famous trainers have had have really turned around when they're in your care.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, one of the things I do when I approach these horses that have issues, I mean, you know, I kind of, you know, instead of thinking that maybe I've got a problem horse, I think that it's probably a horse with a people problem, you know. A problem horse usually the human is at fault for screwing them up. So if you can figure out, you know, what was bugging the horse and change it, then, you know, a lot of times you see really good results. And so, you know, like when somebody sends me a horse and they say, well, this horse is crazy, or, you know, I mean, I don't approach the horse like thinking the horse is crazy. I think that this horse might be bothered, and I try to figure out, you know, what's bugging the horse, you know. I just don't have that mindset, you know, that there's, you know, bad horses out there. Usually it's, you know, 99% of the time we've created the problem, and just, you got to figure out what makes the horse happy.
Kellen, earlier, a few minutes ago, Jude used the term horseman to describe you and your approach to training, and that's a term we hear used quite often when we talk to different trainers. But is that something you take a lot of pride in, as being referred to as a horseman as opposed to just a trainer?
Yeah, I mean, that's you know, I guess always been my goal is to be considered a horseman, you know, probably by my peers. Is, you know, that's pretty important to me. I mean, that's more important than anything. And, you know, I hope I'm on my way.
Why don't you talk about the first horse that put you on the radar? I don't want to say put you on the map, but put you on the radar.
That was a horse that Jude knows very well. I guess it was back in 90, 91 or 92. I was training at a training center called 505 Farm at the time in Lexington, and I have a guy named Lindsey Williams brought me over a three-year-old colt, gelding. I guess it was a gelding, and said, you know, see what we got here. If he's too slow, you know, we'll just make him a point-to-point horse. And so at the time, I was just legging up horses for other people and doing a lot of layups. And so we got this horse ready, and we ran him down at Kentucky Downs. It was my first start, his first start. I actually had to go study for the trainer's test because I didn't have a trainer's license. And took my test and got licensed and headed down to Kentucky Downs. And the horse, he paid like $103 to win. It was the longest shot on the board. We lost our jockey took off like 10 minutes before the race. We had to find a substitute rider. But anyways, the horse went out and won. And four starts later, we took the horse to California, and he won a grade two Sunset Handicap that next summer, and in his fourth start. So, you know, I thought it was a pretty easy game at that point. But his name was Grammarian, and it turns out he was a half brother to St. Nicholas Abbey. So,
well, and I know after that win, it was very tempting for you to make the move and go out on your own, but you didn't make that move at that point. You actually went to work for Windstar, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. Right about that time, right after that win in California, 505 was sold at public auction. And, you know, I had kind of made up my mind I was going to go on my own. But right about that time, I got offered a job at Windstar to be in charge of starting all their colts under tack and doing a lot of their pre-training. And I had two young daughters at the time, and just seemed like a good safe job.
Yeah, I can imagine that trying to go out on your own at that point with the young kids, it's a leap of faith, and it's not an easy decision. We hear that with all professions, not just horse trainers, certainly, but I can imagine how difficult that must have been. How much did you fight yourself internally with wanting to go out and do this on your own, and then the security of a set job at Windstar?
It was a battle. I think I flipped back and forth about four or five times. I mean, I'd already had stalls allotted to me and at the track, and when I got this job offer, and I had a grade two winner in my barn, you know, that I had to give up. So
yeah, no, we talked about it lots of times, back and forth. One day you were all in favor, the next day you go, oh, I don't know. And of course I'm like the little devil on your shoulder going, go for it. You got a lot of talent, you can do it, you know. And then your sensibilities would kick in. I've never been known for my sensibilities.
I mean, you know, at the end of the day, I think it wasn't a bad move going to Windstar. I got to be around some great horses over there and some really great people too. And, you know, it didn't hurt my resume, put it that way.
So who were some of the other people that kind of helped you along the way?
Well, my first boss, of course, was pretty instrumental in bringing me along, and his name is Dale Peters. And then Jack Vanberg. I mean, I worked for Jack in the Midwest circuit for 4 or 5 years after I graduated from college. You know, he taught me a lot, including, you know, how to have great work ethic. You know, Ray Hunt, put him high on my list. You know, there's been numerous people along the way, but, you know, those are some of the ones that jump out at me.
How about on the horse side of things? Who are some of the horses that helped you progress to this point in your career?
Well, I mean, I try to learn something from every horse that I'm around, but, you know, that first winter, I learned a lot from that horse, Grammarian. You know, he was just an average horse when he galloped on a dirt track, and you know, we basically trained that horse in the field, and he felt like a completely different horse. So you know, that horse, and then you know, around some very good horses at Windstar, that like Well Armed and Bluegrass Cat and Drosselmeyer and some of those horses. I mean, you kind of start to see those high level horses. You start to see some similarities, you know, as far as they all have presence and a lot of, you know, class but I try to learn something from every horse.
Talk a little bit about your philosophy with young horses, Kellen. I know that one of the things you're really known for is being able to break young horses and do that very successfully. Talk about that philosophy and your approach to handling young horses when they first come to you.
It goes back to, you know, putting a good foundation on a baby. You know, it's that whole making the right things easy and the wrong things difficult. You know, I think the breaking, the starting the colt under tack, is probably, you know, one of the most important parts of a horse's training. I mean, it's like the foundation. And if you don't have a good foundation, I mean, you know, that's going to show that, you know, those problems that you see a horse having, you know, like at the racetrack where he doesn't want to go in between horses, or, you know, he doesn't turn very good, or, doesn't have a very good mouth, he pulls too hard. I mean, I think all those things can get started, you know, very early. And so, I mean, I think the most important part of a horse's training is really in those first 60 to 90 days. And, you know, I don't know, some people don't think it's, you know, they're race horses, all they got to do is get the saddle on them and go fast, but I beg to differ.
Trainer Kellen Gorder, our special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Kellen, how about your family? You mentioned your daughters. Is it all fillies in your family? Do you have any sons?
Yep, I've got three daughters, and I've got a son that's five.
Okay. Six. Are they into horse racing like you were when you were little?
No, not really. Not really. They all like horses and they all ride. But I wouldn't say they're, you know, race trackers yet.
Do they like to come out and watch dad's horses win?
Oh yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Everybody loves a winner.
Yeah. Yep. Any future trainers among the group or no?
Not sure yet.
So what is it that Kellen Gorder enjoys doing outside of horse racing?
Well, I used to be an avid rock climber, but...
Really?
That's kind of, you know, once my two daughters were born, kind of took a back seat. I was an avid runner, But other than that, I mean, this is kind of all consuming. But that, I mean, it doesn't really seem like a job to me, you know.
But where would you go rock climbing, and what was your greatest triumph on that side of things?
Well, believe it or not, Lexington has a world-class climbing area only about an hour down the road in the Red River Gorge. I mean, it is an endpoint destination when it comes to climbers. I mean, you go down there any given weekend, you're going to run into rock climbers from around the world, you know, Germany, France, Australia. So that's where I spent a lot of time, but I've climbed pretty much all over the country, and I've made a couple attempts on a cliff called El Capitan, which is Yosemite, California. But yeah, I've done the overnight climbs where you're in those little cots that you hang, that are basically hanging off the side of a cliff. Done that, and a big part of my life, really.
What's a bigger rush, making it to the top of a cliff like that, or watching one of your horses storm to victory?
Probably watching a horse win. Yeah.
There's nothing beats that. I really don't think there's anything that beats that. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. Well, Kellen, we want to wish you all the best with your future success here, and appreciate you taking the time to tell us your story here tonight, and looking forward to catching up with you here soon, my friend. All of our guests who appear on the program receive the gift courtesy of one of our sponsors, Flair Equine Nasal Strips, so we will get those out to you. And again, thanks so much for taking the time.
All right. Thank you.
All right, Trainer Kellen Gorder, our special guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Interesting. A rock climber. That's the first time we've heard that.
Yeah. Well, I knew Kellen was a rock climber. He used to go when we worked at 505 together, and he used to scare me to death because I figured, oh, my God, how's he going to do this, you know?
He's not
what if something
back.
Happens to him?
Yeah.
So, but yeah, he always loved it, and, it was something it would never even occur to me to go rock climbing, but he always loved it.
Still can't surpass.
He never invited me to go either. I think he knew I wasn't really.
yeah.
I got feet like Flintstone, you know.
You'll cheer him on from below.
Yeah, I was just always happy to see him when he came home.
Yeah. Still can't surpass the thrill of seeing your horse cross the finish line. It's a great game.
It really is.
Going to be a fun interview coming up in the second half of the program as well. We're going to visit with trainer Richie Schossberg. Stay tuned for that on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Fasic Tipton, where will you be? Make plans now to attend the Fasic Tipton Mid-Atlantic December Mix Sale on December 9th, and be sure to nominate your horse to the Kentucky Winter Mix Sale by December 9th, sale date February 10th. And things really start heating up March 24th with the Florida Sale. For more information, visit FasicTipton.com. That's FasicTipton.com. Fasic Tipton, where will you be? I'm here with Dr. Jim Chiappetta from Flair, maker of Flair Equine Nasal Strips. Jim, how do Flair strips, when applied to a horse's nose, help protect their lungs?
Mike, studies show that 90% of the resistance to airflow in exercising horses is in the upper airway, with the majority of that being in the nose. When exercising at high intensity, many horses can bleed into their lungs. The strips have been shown to reduce that bleeding by reducing the resistance to airflow through the nasal passages. This keeps horses healthy by keeping their lungs healthier during performance and training.
To learn more, visit flairstrips.com. On Wednesday, November 27th, the eyes of the racing world will be focused on Penn National Racecourse as many of the country's top sprinters highlight the $250,000 Fabulous Strike Handicap on Thanksgiving Eve. First post is 6 p.m., and the evening will feature an all-stakes early pick four culminating with the $250,000 Fabulous Strike as race number four. The night before Thanksgiving, feast on a terrific plate of steaks at Penn National. Visit hcpn.com/racing for more information.
Thank you. The $1 million Delta Downs jackpot, Saturday, November 23rd. Delta Downs Racetrack, Casino, and Hotel in Vinted, Louisiana is running 11 exciting thoroughbred races worth over $2 million in purses. First post time is 1:15 p.m. Central. The jackpot goes off at 4:15. Bet with the big money and play the $200,000 guaranteed jackpot day all stakes pick four. You could really hit the jackpot. For all the action on November 23rd, watch it live on DRF.com, DRF Bets, or at a simulcast location near you. For more information about the $1 million Delta Downs jackpot, keep reading Daily Racing Form or visit DRF.com and DeltaDownsJackpot.com.
Want to know what we're up to?
Yeah.
Then log on to HorseRacingRadio.net.
It appears that the website has become alive.
HorseRacingRadio.net is your official home for HRRN on the web. Read our blogs, download our podcasts, link up to our Twitter and Facebook pages, listen to live streaming of all of our broadcasts, and much more. HRRN is your home for racing's biggest events, and our home on the web is HorseRacingRadio.net. That's HorseRacingRadio.net.
Hi, I'm Richard Migliori, and I love listening to Horse Racing Radio Network. Good night, Barbados.
And welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Pennant, Jude Feld, our producer Lee Delapina in our Lexington, Kentucky studios. JT, a really fun visit with Kellen Gorder in the first half of the program. Interesting to hear his story. It was a bit different than some of the other trainers that we've had the chance to speak with on this program over the past year or so.
Yeah, he's had an interesting life and came to the business in a unique way. So that was fun. I've known Kellen for a long time, but our next guest I've never met.
Yeah, our next guest may be too smart for this program, by the way. He's a graduate of Cornell University. I can't even say that word, see? A graduate of Cornell. He is 51 years old. He is a native of White Plains, New York, and his name is Richard Schossberg. And Richard, thanks so much for being with us here tonight on Trainer Talk.
Thank you. I'm having a little trouble hearing you.
All right, let's see. How's that? Is that a little bit better?
Yeah, that's much better. Thanks.
All right, great. Yeah, happy to have you on board with us here tonight. And what is it about Cornell turning out these top trainers up there in New York? I know Chad Brown went to Cornell as well.
Well, you know, Cornell gives you an opportunity. First of all, it's one of the largest ag schools on the East Coast. And a lot of opportunity to learn equine science, animal science, along with getting a good background in business and economics, which is what I studied. I studied economics and spent a lot of time up at the vet school as much as I could, getting some practical knowledge on physiology and reproduction and nutrition and just basic. They had courses strictly for equine. And there's been quite a few of us come through there and ended up, in the horse industry here in New York at all levels.
So, were you around horses from a very young age?
Kind of an interesting story. My dad was the chief of staff for a U.S. congressman, and he was working on the Hill in the late '60s. And early 70s, and we had moved out of, we lived in Georgetown, we moved out into the suburbs when I was about seven, and decided, you know, I just, the very beginnings of a long and not illustrious football career at that age also, but we were looking for other things to do for my sister and I, and she had joined 4-H, and we got involved with getting, taking riding lessons out in the in the rural sections of Virginia and Reston and Herndon is where we lived. And we got very, very interested in the horse business there. We ended up buying a little farm out in Herndon and bought a racehorse off the track it was either Shenandoah or Charlestown. They were doing the circuit down there, Penn National, Shenandoah, and Charlestown. That was that was kind of my my breaking in phase. And I was, you know, around 10 years old, going to the races at Charlestown at night through the Blue Ridge Mountains and pulling a two-horse trailer.
That's pretty cool. But,
yeah, it was interesting. And, you know, my mom and dad, we ended up, that horse that we bought, we made a show horse out of her, and my sister was a top show rider at that time, you know, once she had perfected her skills, and I was really, really skilled with a pitchfork and a shovel, and I still am. And we ended up using that mare after her show career was over as a broodmare, and she's, to make a long story short, she's the grand dam of a New York bred champion named Mellow Roll that Todd Pletcher had for Anstu Stable back a decade ago or so. And that was the beginning of our breeding operation, and my mom and dad still breed up in New York, and my mom does some pinhooking. She's very active at the Keeneland sales, the Fizzy Pickton sales, both in Kentucky and Saratoga. And my dad, we moved back up into New York after he changed positions into the banking business, and we bought a farm up here in New York. And he spent two terms as the president of the New York Thoroughbred Breeders. He's a brilliant guy with a great business mind and an ungodly passion for thoroughbred racing, and still is and still does. And they still have the farm up there, and it's in Katona now. And that was kind of the beginning of it for our family. And I graduated Cornell in the mid-'80s, and after having spending all my summers working for trainers like Walter Kelly up here in New York, and I worked for Eddie Gaudette down in Delaware and Bowie and Maryland, you know, in my teenage years, and cut my teeth down there. And after I graduated Cornell, I hooked up with Sidney Waters, who had a big stable and was about to get bigger because the Firestones had hired him. And he needed somebody to run a whole nother barn for him. And we had some connections with Sidney through several of his owners, and he hired me. And as long as Firestone stayed with him, I stayed there. And that was when I had my first assistant trainer's job.
That's a fantastic story. I mean, how your entire family got involved in the business. I mean, you know, that's really amazing. That's a first here on Trainer Talk where people weren't in the horse business and the whole family gets in. I mean, that's sensational, really.
Yeah, it was a family operation. We learned to drive a tractor at a young age, and we were doing our own fields. And you know, we had cornfields and stuff that we were growing our own vegetables, and we had the horses and the foals. We learned all about, you know, foaling and bringing up babies and weaning them, and you know, the cycling of the mares and how to breed back on the foal heat and all that stuff. I mean, we're a full layered operation here, and the only one that spun off a little bit was my sister. She went to Cornell also, started out as a pre-vet, ended up pre-med, went on to Mount Sinai Med School, and she's a pediatrician and runs a large practice of her own over in New Jersey. But she's done her thing, very successful, and she keeps an eye on how we're doing over here at Aqueduct in Belmont, Saratoga.
Talking with trainer Richard Schausberg here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Richard, did you always kind of have it in the back of your mind that you wanted to train horses for a living, or were there some other directions you thought about going early in your career?
Well, about my sophomore year, I decided that I actually did have a passion for it. So I geared my curriculum more towards the physiology, nutrition, reproduction, equine science that I could. I mean, in my major, a lot of it was bovine. It had a lot to do with, everything from milking cows to growing corn and corn silage and how it ferments and all that stuff, which is terrific. Not exactly what I was looking for, but I could tweak it, and I could take, there are so many courses, so many opportunities up there, and more so now, at Cornell, where you can really gear your curriculum to what you want in any field of animal science. And if you want to really go in over your head and dive in, you know, to the deep end, you go pre-vet and try and get into a vet school, one of the 28 vet schools in the country, which is very, very difficult. I opted to go this route, and I think I made a good decision. I work for good people. I was an assistant trainer for Tom Skiffington during his big heyday years in the mid-80s, where we had some top turf horses and amongst others, and some really good graded state dirt horses. And he taught me a tremendous amount about how to handle really top quality horses and how to train them and keep them sound. He's a terrific horseman. And I also met my wife in the middle of all that too, right here at Belmont Park. And we've been married. We'll have our 25th anniversary coming up this year.
Oh, congratulations. And what was her role on the racetrack? Was she galloping horses or was she working with somebody else?
Yeah, she owned horses, and I was working for Tommy, and she had brought horses in from New Jersey just for the winter. And we absolutely despised each other for the first month and a half until we got to know each other a little bit better. And it's been great ever since. We have I've got a 21-year-old son who's going to be graduating Boston University this year, who has gone in his own direction. He's going to he's a marine scientist. He's going to clean up the oceans and make sure that that whatever we have messed up and over the past 200, 300, 400 years, he's going to clean up, which is a good endeavor, and he's passionate about it, and he'll go on to grad school and do his thing. But he also knows his way around the stable pretty well too.
Well, that's fantastic. That's a great aspiration because our oceans certainly need a lot of help. I would imagine too that your business background, your business studies have helped you in your training career as well.
Yeah, and a lot of it has changed quite a bit. As a matter of fact, I just had a meeting this morning with some people and discussing how the business of racing has changed. And it used to be we all had our own section. The trainers would be trainers or a trainer owner, and you do your thing with your horses, and that's it. Now it has really turned into a business where we really have to know what kind of government regulations are required to run a business. It used to be people would come into work and they'd do their thing, they'd race, and they'd, you know. Now you're under Department of Labor standards, and you're under INS and IRS, and there's so many different rules and regulations that we have to know because we're running a business. And I've recently got elected onto the board of directors for the New York Thoroughbred Horsemen's Association. And I decided after 20 years of training or 22 years of training, it was time for me to try and give back a little bit to the New York racing scene. And it's been very gratifying for me with regards to working with other trainers on regulations with regards to hourly wages and overtime and sick days and stuff like that no one ever knew anything about. None of the trainers that we came up under knew anything about that kind of thing until DOL came in and said, this is what you got to do, and we, you know, we'll keep checking on you. And also we're very passionate about the Aftercare Alliance, which is a nationwide situation for horses that are looking for second careers or places to go after retirement. And I've been appointed to the chair of what we call the Take the Lead Foundation up here in New York, where horses in New York that are no longer viable for racing, they'll come to us. And we have partnered up with New Vocations, with Anna Ford down in Kentucky, and with Akendale Rescue, and with Rerun, and Second Chance, and War Horse. And what we do is we help these trainers that come to us, or these owners come to us, with a horse that's in a situation where he's no longer viable for racing, but can be trained on for a second career. And that's another thing that we've just started in March, and I think we're up to 25 already since March, which has been fantastic. And the vets have put in their time for free to come in and check these horses out, go over x-rays, go over ultrasounds, and you know, if we have a question on something, they'll get a little vet committee together all on their own time. And the vanning companies, Sally especially, and Brookledge, they've been taking these horses to these second care facilities for free for us. Just been a, you know, it's been a really gratifying situation for me to be able to do it. It's a lot of busy work, but it's a lot of gratifying, satisfying work for me to know that these horses can have a soft place to land when they've put so much effort and tried to give us so much pleasure in our industry.
And it's great to hear the stories of you giving back, Richard, to the game that has given you so much. You've had so many outstanding moments in your career with training horses. According to Equibase, you are one win shy of the 800 win milestone. And I know that's going to be coming sooner rather than later. Your
well,
first winner.
Let's hope it comes in about 2 hours.
Your first winner on September 4th of 1988, Three Chopped Road, the first horse that you ever started when you went out on your own. Were you thinking, hey, what's so hard about this game?
Well, I could see that you might think that, although I've been through it as an assistant enough times to know that there's ups and downs. And I think I tried to ground myself after that happened. That being said, he was my first horse. We bought him from my friend Mike Hushin, actually, way back. I watched him run on TV. He was parked wide for 17.5 or something and finished fifth. And I said, this will be a perfect horse for me to get started with. And we talked to Mike, and we paid more than he was worth. But in the long run, it was a great experience. I still have the win picture. Sits right in my foyer. It's the first thing you see when you walk into my house. It's my mom and my dad and my wife and I, and we look like children, and my mom and dad look like I do now. And it was in the slop, and he went wire to wire with Jerry Bailey on his back, and that started the ball rolling. Ironically, that horse as an individual didn't win many races. He won a lot of money. He was second 25 times. And he was just a great horse to have. You know, he was frustrating because he never seemed to get there, but it was ironic that he won his first start, and he was part of the exact and more often than not on the other end of it. But I had him for a very long time. He died at age 18. And I actually bought a little farm on Long Island to retire him and a horse you probably remember back in the mid-90s, horse named As Indicated, who was a multiple stakes winner, grade one winner for us, who won the Pimlico Special. And he was a gelding. And I retired the two of them out here on Long Island, and they were paddock buddies for 8 or 9 years, and went on to do some really cool things, some therapeutic work with physically and mentally handicapped kids down in Kentucky, the two of them. And it was just a great time, you know, back then. Things have changed a little bit, but I've had some really good horses along the way. Probably the most famous horse I've had, or maybe one of them, is a Firm Success. He ran in four different Breeders' Cups and two different divisions, and never ended up winning one, but he sure put in a great effort and made over $2 million. He, in fact, is that old friends down in Kentucky with Mike Blowen, who was a fantastic aftercare facility for horses of certain stature, and it's a great organization down there.
Yeah, Michael does great work, but it sounds like you really have a love for the animals above everything else.
You know, I really, really do, and I've done a few owner seminars here when they've asked me to do it and about getting started. And what keeps me going, and I'll tell you what, whether you've had the worst day or the best day, if you go into your horse's stall, whether just pick a horse out in your barn or if you have one horse, and just go sit in the corner of that horse's stall, they'll feed off your emotions, whether it's elation or it's you're in the doldrums of sadness from some terrible thing that may have happened. And they feed off of you more so even than some dogs, because we're big dog people too. But some of these horses can really feed off your emotion. And just sitting there, that really grounds you, whether you've just gotten beaten in a stake at 3-5 or whether you just had a horse run off the screen at 18-1. or whether some other thing happened in your life that had nothing to do with your business, they really respond to your emotion. And I think that's, you know, not to segue into something else, but I think that's why certain jocks get along with so many horses at a certain level. It's just the horse feels through them. A jock like Ramon Dominguez, who's, you know, just had the most incredible rapport with almost any horse he ever got on his back, whether he'd been on him before, whether he'd ridden him in six different grade ones. But the emotional bond between people and horses, you know, goes way far beyond the American history, but obviously. But it's one thing that really grounds you when you're in this business. If you ever get ahead of yourself, or if you ever think you're getting way behind yourself, take a moment, go sit in the stall, and let the horse nuzzle you a little bit. It'll ground you.
Yeah, trainer Richard Schausberg, our special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton here on HRRN. Richard, it sounds like you're echoing the sentiments of so many other trainers that have appeared on this program in the past several months, where the horses really become very much like a part of your family. And I know one of those horses for you had to be your champion two-year-old of 1995, Maria's Mon. And to get the news in 2007 that he had died, it had to be just a devastating blow.
It really was. He was so far ahead of the class mentally. Now, that year, it was a plethora of talented two-year-olds. You had Hennessy, Unbridled Song, Editor's Note, Louis Couture. The list was endless. The 95 two-year-old crop had to be in the top five over the last four decades. It just seemed like each one of them could have taken that championship. And when this horse came to me, and it was one of the first horses I had ever had for the Rosenthals, and I got to thank John DeStefano, who's a really good friend of our family, a trainer in his own right. He runs syndicates now, and I still train for them. And he had recommended the Rosenthals, recommended me to the Rosenthals. He was training for him. He said, Rick's a young, up-and-coming trainer, blah, blah, blah. He's good for John's good friends with my wife, Dawn, for 30 years. And the second horse that walked into my barn off of that off the farm was Maria's Mon. And not for any reason is that this one goes there, that one goes there. He was very modestly bred horse. He was by Wavering Monarch. The mare was ordinary, and he had a half-brother that broke his maiden for a quarter, I think it called it. But when he got off the van and he walked in the barn in his first day to the racetrack, it was like he was a five-year-old. And, you know, I was a relatively young trainer. I'd started in 88, and I could see that he was a special kind of horse, but I didn't, you know, also being, you know, my father's a connoisseur of breeding and pedigree. So that being instilled in me, I kept saying, well, he is kind of by Wavering Monarch and the mare's not so much. And maybe he's just a real classy horse. But, and he didn't like to work very fast. You know, he did exactly what he needed to do, which, you know, as I got older and more experienced as a trainer, you realize that that's the horse saying, you know, train me this way. It's okay. You don't have to go in 59. I can do that, but you don't need to see me do that. And he was just a brilliant horse. And he broke his maiden, if I'm not mistaken, on the 4th of July of that year. And he drew off by 10 under Robbie Davis, who at that point was my stable rider. He drew off and won by 10, and Louis Couture was in that race, and he was a distant second.
Wow.
A real classy horse. And, you know, and then he won the Sanford in his second start, had a little hiccup in the hopeful where Hennessy won. We kind of laid back on him a little bit, but we wanted to try and get to the Breeders' Cup that year. And he won the Futurity handily, and he won the Champagne with like 103 buyer figure, which was outstanding. It's outstanding for any age horse, much less a two-year-old. And unfortunately, he took a bad step galloping one day and ended up with a small condylar, non-displaced condylar fracture that we ended up obviously missing the Breeders' Cup. But we eked out a championship, and the only reason we eked out the championship is because Unbridled Song beat Hennessy in the Breeders' Cup by a nose. It was that's what made the difference. Wayne and I were campaigning for our two horses. He was campaigning for Hennessy, and I was a small stable, small, relatively unknown trainer campaigning this superstar 2-year-old who was going to watch from the bench. And I'll never forget when, you know, Wayne had made a couple of comments about, you know, how could they give the Eclipse Award to a horse that never left New York? And Hennessy had basically been all over. He'd run in Kentucky and obviously was running in the Breeders' Cup and all that. And I kind of off the cuff made a comment. I said, well, they don't give championships for frequent flyer miles. They give championships for winning grade one. So here's a 30-something-year-old kid taking on the master in the press. And I'll never forget, he called me at 5 o'clock in the morning. He was probably already at the barn for 3 hours, knowing him. Well, 2 hours anyway. And he called me, got my number, and he called me, and he said, Rick, I got to tell you, it was a great comeback. He said, you said exactly what you had to say. You're campaigning for your horse because he's sitting on the bench. I'm campaigning for mine. He says, I respect you, and may the best horse win. He says, but it's going to be a great campaign. And you guys know Wayne probably better than anybody. You could see him saying that.
Oh, yeah.
And, I gained the utmost respect for him, and I think he gained a little respect for me at that point, too. And we duked it out till the end. And, again, we were sitting on the sidelines watching. And I have to say, I was rooting awfully hard for Unbridled Song. Because if Hennessy had won that, then it was a slam dunk that he got the championship. But we'd already won our two grade ones, and Tennessee had won the hopeful, and that was it at that point. So that's how close it was. And like I said, there were so many horses in that crop that went on to do great things, both on the track and in the breeding shed. And Maria's Mon ended up in his first crop, had a horse named Monarcos, and when he won the Kentucky Derby, Dawn and I sat on the couch and watched, and it's like watching your grandson hit a grand slam in the World Series. When that happened, I was in tears. When it's his first crop, and he went and passed that along to his offspring like that, and he ended up having another one in Super Saver. So, I mean, not too many horses have two Kentucky Derby winners. And his stud career was cut way short when he passed away. I think he was 12. Ended up being like a laminitis. He had some infection down there at Pin Oak, and they had to put him down, which was one of the saddest days of my career.
Well, on top of it, he's turned out to be a fantastic broodmare sire as well. So he's just one of those horses that was very special.
Yeah. Well, his pedigree, it was P.G. Johnson and Dr. Hart did the pedigree on that horse. And, you know, because P.G. was training for the Rosenthals for years. And Ed Nasker, obviously, trained Nasker for the Rosenthals. And that was a Hickory sire and broodmare sire. And he had that going back into his pedigree. So you knew you had stamina, and you knew unfortunately you got hurt as a 2-year-old, but you had a lot of soundness built into that pedigree and a lot of stamina too. So if he could, and also turf pedigree too, because not only Wavering Monarch was, I know he didn't run that many times on the turf, but he was a turf champion. And so you had a lot of turf pedigree in there too, which will make for a longer career and maybe sustain their soundness longer too. So you got to think, it really goes back to P.G. Johnson and Dr. Pug Hart, who was doing the pedigrees on these horses for the Rosenthal. And it was a couple of generations prior to him, and now he's passing it on. And, of course, he's a top broodmare sire and a sire, but, again, his stud career got cut short.
Well, Richard, how to believe we're already out of time. The story's incredible. Your life, your career, outstanding. And we can't thank you enough for spending a little time with us here on Trainer Talk tonight. And looking forward to catching up with you here up the road. All the best on number 800 and beyond. And, of course, all of our guests who appear on the program will receive gifts courtesy of one of our sponsors, Flair Equine Nasal Strips. So we'll get those out to you. And, again, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Appreciate it. And, of course, now that you mentioned the 800 and we're one away, it'll be 3 months.
Oh, no. I'm going to go to the window. You're set.
All right. Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Rich. Richard Schatzberg here on Trainer Talk. Wow.
That was a great story.
Amazing.
Yeah.
That Maria's Mon story. Incredible. Really cool. Yeah. Well, we do want to thank Kellen Gorder and Richard for taking the time. Want to thank our producer, Lee Delapina, and of course, for the pontiff, Jude Feld. I'm Mike Pena. We'll talk to you next time here on HRN.
Good night, Barbados.